The following teaching is part 19 of a 33-part study of the Book of Colossians by Dr. Ken Boa.
We are going to finish chapter 2 of Colossians. I think you'll find that to be a pleasant move because we've been in that chapter for a long time. I don't know how many sessions we've had so far on this, but the last verses 16 to 23, can be taken as a unit. We've seen, again, in this book, the theme of the supremacy and the sufficiency and the sovereignty of Christ, that He is supreme over all things in the heavens and on earth and under the earth. He created all things and all things were made for Him and all things are under His authority and rule. He is sufficient because there is nothing that's necessary besides Him for us to have all that we need. We have all the fullness of Godhead in bodily form in Christ, and He has fully equipped us. Because of our identification with Christ, we now have the power to imitate Him. One may parenthetically stress again that you cannot imitate Christ unless you've been identified with Him. Identification is the key to imitation. What I mean by that is what we just saw earlier, that we were identified with Christ in His death, burial, resurrection, and ascension. And it is because of what God's done for us in that way that He gives us the power to imitate Christ. And it's even there, it's Christ in you. Even there, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. But then He goes on to say that the life I live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. So there's a mutuality. It's not just one, it's both. It's a divine-human synergy. He's made us sufficient. He's supreme. He's sovereign. And this is Paul's point because he's now going to directly address the opponents that are really trying to deceive the people in Colossae to give them some sort of a syncretistic notion of another approach that says, you know, Christ is good, but you need something more. You know, when you study the cults, you discover the same thing, don't you? You read, for example, Mormon literature. And they'll talk about, yeah, you need faith in Christ, but you also need works, and you need to be this, and you need to be that. We've got a litany of things. So Christ alone is never enough. Salvation by grace through faith is not something you'll ever find in other religions, and certainly we won't find it in the cults. Jehovah's Witnesses, the same situation there. Really, it's a works-based salvation. It is the idea that Christ made it possible for us to be saved, but now we have to do it. And that's the mindset. It's insufficient. Let's take a look then at these verses. I'm going to begin with verse 16, go to the end of the chapter. Paul, therefore, in view of all that he has described so far concerning the sufficiency and person of Christ, therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of the angels, taking his stand on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind, and not holding fast to the head from whom the entire body being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments grows with a growth which is from God. If you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, which all refer to things destined to perish with use, in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men? These are matters which have to be sure their appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. Now, this particular passage, it's not exactly clear the specific nature of their religious observances, but it seems to involve a few components. It involves some acknowledgement of Jesus, but it's really a self-made, do-it-yourself approach to religion. It's pretty syncretistic, which, by the way, is where we are today. We're a very syncretistic culture. Being pluralistic, we take bits and pieces from all kinds of areas and put them together and feel that, and we like the word spirituality, so we say that spirituality is good. You know, as you know, religion's out, spirituality is in. I'm sure you've all noticed that by now. Of course, what do we mean by spirituality? It could mean Native American spirituality. It can be tantric spirituality, Eastern, any number of things that you can have as spiritualities. That doesn't mean, therefore, that I can't use the word. I just have to define what I mean by it because it is a good word. point here is that people are picking and choosing. This seemed to be some kind of a combination of some kind of a self-imposed disciplines, some kind of ascetic practices, in other words, that they felt made them superior to other people because they were involved in self-abasement and self-imposed disciplines. They've therefore said that unless you're doing this, you're not really spiritual. This is the mindset. A sort of a throwback as well to a legalism and something like a mysticism, almost like an Oriental mysticism, related to various visions that they claim they have seen. And a kind of a worship of the elementary principles. Whether this refers to the worship of angels or something of that sort, it's not entirely clear. But I think it has relevance to our own situation today. Let's go back and look at a couple of these verses 16 and 17 first. Therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. Things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. What does he mean by that, the idea of shadow and substance? If you go to the book of Hebrews, you discover that use, that imagery of shadow versus substance. What he's saying, what the author to Hebrews says again and again, is that the shadow was under the Mosaic economy. But that really was now replaced by the reality, the substance. In other words, the tabernacle and the temple were only a shadow, an earthly shadow, of a more real heavenly tabernacle and temple. Furthermore, the sacrificial systems were only a shadow, a foretaste of that sacrifice which alone could take away sins, namely the blood of Christ, because the blood of bulls and of goats can never take away from sins. All that did was put off the debt. Just pushed off the debt for another year, Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, and all the other sacrifices. And the debt continued to mount. The point is, those sacrifices, all the various five kinds of sacrifices that are prescribed in the book of Leviticus, were all portraits, really, of Messiah himself. But now we have Christ, we don't go back to the sacrifices. Now that you have grace, you don't go back to the law. In other words, the law was revealed through Moses, John writes. Grace and truth were realized in Jesus Christ. Note the contrast. That's John 1, where he says, the law was revealed through Moses. That was a law that was given, as Paul says, to be a schoolmaster to drive us to faith, because the law reveals the standards of God that are far higher than human standards. The law reveals the fact that we cannot attain to this relationship. It, in fact, drives us to the point where we realize that unless we have the grace of God, we cannot possibly live this life. Though sadly, so many people slip back into law-based living, don't they? Checklist living. Isn't it true that when you first come to faith in Christ, you hear a bunch of do's? People give you a do list? In other words, now that you come to be a believer, how do you grow? Well, do this, do that, and the other. So give me some of the do's that you should do. Not that these are bad things, don't get me wrong, but what are some of the do's that you're told to do? Go to church, read the Bible, pray, give money away, share your faith, spend time, all those things. And by the way, they're all good things. Don't get me wrong, but I hear very little of being. I hear a bunch of doing things. You do this, do that, do the other. But I don't hear much that relates to the whole idea of cultivating intimacy. Yes, those disciplines are means to that end, but often we just do them because we're told to do them. That's the problem there. Then they become ends in themselves, and you do them because you were told to do them. And what'll happen then you're told to serve. And what happens with service is you're trying to serve out of your own resources because you don't know the fullness of your identification with Christ. And then that kind of service will burn you out and lead to frustrated inadequacy. You realize that you can't do it. Actually, that frustrated inadequacy is a very good thing for you to experience, is it not? Because then only do you realize that through brokenness, it's the power of Christ that manifests his life, and only when you are weak is he strong. So you realize that you minister out of weakness, not out of your own strength. The point, though, I'm going back to, is the fact that we hear all kinds of things that we're told to do, and people like do lists. Because you can quantify that, you can measure it, and people are more comfortable with law than they are with grace. Isn't that so? I mean, frankly, a lot of people would like to be told exactly when to pray, how long to pray, and what to do, and that's exactly what Islam does. Islam, there's no ambiguity there. It's one of the reasons why it grows so fast, is because there's no ambiguity. It's totally black and white. You pray five times a day. you face Mecca. You have a specific ritual. It's actually choreographed. Their prayers are not to cultivate intimacy with Allah, because Allah cannot be known in a relationship. Rather, they are ritual acts of submission to Allah's will. And it involves standing and kneeling and prostrating oneself and so forth. And it's always the same formula, the same routine. You see the idea? But here's the nice part about that. You know when you're doing it and you know when you're not. You see, you can measure that deal. And there are five basic pillars. And basically, they're all quantifiable. You know it when you're doing it. And people are comfortable with that. They like it because it's very, very transferable, very easy to measure, and people like being able to measure and count and control. Grace you can't measure. Grace you cannot count. But the point is, grace is desperately necessary, because once we recognize that our own efforts can never attain righteousness before God, then we come to the realization that it is faith. And it is by the grace of God that we live this spiritual life. So one of the things I find in our own culture that's so characteristic then is what you might call designer religions. Designer religions, or where people go up to the cafeteria and pick out the bits they like. And if something really doesn't appeal to them, no problem. I can belly up to the trough and get something else. You see, I can always go back and get something else. Didn't like that? Okay, let me dabble in this. And you can be sure that the probably the baseline of all this, the bottom line, the dregs, would be what Hollywood characters get into and people in the popular music industry. What they do is they create this very superficial thing, like Madonna into the Kabbalah. Give me a break. She has no clue as to what's going on in that. It's a very, very rigorous and ascetic system. We're not talking about a rigorous and ascetic woman here. What we got there is just a kind of a Hollywood glitz and glamour version of it, of spirituality. You see the concept there? Just something, and little bit of something for everybody, or Scientology. Again, you have Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise and others.
John Travolta,
you know. And again, even there, they're only dabblers in those kinds of things, but all they are work systems, little systems of doing these, and you get that. My point here, you can get involved in astrology, then you can drop that and go for some form of occultism or whatever. And you know, that's a very easy thing for us to slip into. Now in the church, the danger there is to slip into some kind of externally based religious practice. And that's why he says food or drink, festival or new moon or Sabbath day. Those are all relate to a Jewish ritual. I find very little about the idea of self-examination. There is meditation in some of the systems and so forth. There are ritual acts and so forth, but I see very little about on the dimension of real moral reflection as to why I do what I do. I'm told that these are the agencies that will lead to that. I follow them, whatever ascetic practices I get into. And the problem was that legalistic practices, such as what you eat and drink and your festival, your new moon, your Sabbath day, has to do with special places and special times. Didn't Paul make it real clear in Romans 14 that for some people, they regard every day as alike? Another regards one day as more important than another. Let each man be fully convinced in his own mind. In other words, the idea of festivals and new moon, Sabbath days, and kosher laws, dietary laws, are no longer to be seen in the New Testament. That is something that was a product of the law. And by the way, they fiercely expanded on the law in their own oral traditions. The law had very clear requirements of what was clean and unclean, but just to do it one better, the Jewish community eventually formulated through oral traditions all kinds of extra laws that God never even thought of, you see. And if 10 commandments are good, 100 are better. You see, that way if you do these 100 commandments, chances are you're not going to violate the others. You see the concept there? So let me give you an example of how human nature and human religion works. And it's very much along this line. There's one verse in the Old Testament that says, "You shall not see the kid in its mother's milk." That sounds like a strange verse, isn't it? In other words, you don't seethe a kid, a goat, in its mother's milk. Well, why would you ever think about doing that, you know? Well, because it was a Canaanite practice. In other words, it was a practice in certain Canaanite practices of religion, and he did not want the people to be associated with that at all. But here's what came out of that one verse. Yet eventually we have now, in Orthodox homes, you have two sets of dishes, one for dairy and one for meat, you see, and you can never mix the two. In other words, you cannot have dairy. Get the idea? Where did that come from? The milk and the meat. You get the idea there? Beef stroganoff would not serve very well, no. Nor can you have a cheeseburger, you see? If you go to a McDonald's in Jerusalem, you're probably not going to be able to get a cheeseburger. I remember I went there in Jerusalem. We went to the milk. There was this dairy bar, a milk bar, and you can get all these dairy products and so forth, but don't ask for meat, you know. So you don't want any combination of those two because of this law. But did the scriptures teach that you were not supposed to not have dairy and meat? Never said that. But we've invented this, so it got very complex and very elaborate indeed. Same was true with the Sabbath. Got to the point where with the Sabbath, that if you were really Orthodox, like a friend of mine in Brooklyn, he is the token Gentile in his community. He's surrounded. His whole community is Jewish. And he lived there a long while, and more Jewish people came in and bought up around him, but they never moved. And what was interesting is that they found him to be a great utility because on Sabbath, they couldn't turn on and turn off the lights and do other things too because that would be regarded as work. You catch the idea here? So that he'd have to go turn on and turn off the lights and do other kinds of things. This isn't something you found in the Hebrew Bible or a Sabbath day's journey. And there were ways around that. You'd go 3/5 of a mile was supposed to be a Sabbath day journey. You couldn't go any further than that. But if you brought a meal with you, you know, like you pack your lunch and bring it with you and then stopped at 3/5 of a mile and ate, then that would be your new home. And then you could go another 3/5 of a mile. Really interesting stuff that people can come up with. So what they do is they come up with all kinds of laws. And then what they do is come up with ways of sidestepping those laws. You see, it's very interesting how that worked. The idea of not doing work on the Sabbath didn't have to do with the effort of turning something on or turning something off. You see the idea? If that's the case, then you better lay flat in bed because it's work just to raise your hand. People love law. They love it because they love to quantify, calculate, control, manipulate. They just like that. And we're all like that in one way or another. People are not comfortable with grace because if we teach that it's by grace that we are not only saved but are sanctified by grace through faith, then what will happen is a minister who understands the idea of the doctrines of grace might be afraid still to really teach them. I know of some pastors who went to a conference where they were talking about this whole idea of grace-based living. And they all agreed. They came to the conclusion that this is the way one ought to live. But it turned out that most of them didn't teach this to their congregations. And when asked, one of them was honest enough to say, because if I do, I'm afraid the people go off the deep end. They might think, get all kinds of ideas in their heads, you see. So he wants them to be on law so they can control them. He can dispense grace, you see. And the point is, that's exactly what Paul says. Shall we sin in order that grace might increase? End of Romans 5 and then Romans 6. The point here is that people are not comfortable with grace. They think that people go and abuse it. And I think that's to misunderstand the nature of grace. In any case, he's saying, don't let someone judge you on those levels. In Romans 14, he said, look, the weaker brother has these compunctions. He feels that he cannot eat, for example, meat. He can only eat vegetables, or he has to worship on certain days. And Paul says, look, if you want to buy that, that's fine. The weaker brother doesn't have faith to do those things. But don't let the weaker judge the stronger brother, because we're not dealing with commands, we're dealing with convictions. You catch the difference? Very important that you grasp the difference between a conviction and a command. You can have a conviction about how you might celebrate, quote, the Sabbath, like Eric Little did. Remember on Sunday, which he regarded as the Sabbath, although the Sunday was never the Sabbath, but in any case, he felt that you shouldn't play soccer on the Sabbath. Remember, these kids were playing soccer and football, as they call it there. And what happened, of course, is that he discovered to his horror that when he went to on his way to the Olympics, that they had scheduled his heat on a Sunday. And so he had a conviction that he'd already told others not to do this. He himself had to comply with that. Now, my own view is he could have run the heat on Sunday. I don't have any problem with that. But if that's his conviction, then he would be violating his conscience. And whatever is not of faith is sin, Paul says in Romans 14. Get the idea? If you can't do it, so one person can see a movie and it's not sin for him. Another person sees the same movie, and for him it's sin because they didn't have the faith to do it. You catch the idea? So the principle is simply this. Let the stronger brother not be looked down on the weaker brother, and don't let the weaker brother condemn or criticize the stronger brother. And if necessary, the stronger brother, who, for example, let's say has the ability, let's say, for example, they go out to a restaurant, and he might normally order wine, but he realizes that the person he's with has convictions about that, then his course, according to Romans 14, would be to restrict himself out of love for the weaker brother, also to keep the person from being tempted to sin by going along with him and violating his own faith. You see the point there? Is it hypocrisy that you choose not to order wine? So when I would do walk through the Bible seminars around the country years ago, I got to the point, some of you know the story, when I got to the point where I could forget where I was and my mouth kept moving. I knew I'd taught too many of those seminars. I think it was in Opelika where this happened, of all places. And I was doing, there a few hundred people in the audience. It's not hypocrisy, though, to restrain your freedom and your liberty for the benefit of another. It's not hypocrisy. What you're doing is serving the weaker brother. I mention all this because these people would have supposed that if you didn't follow their rules and regulations, you were unspiritual. That's why I'm saying this. And people go slip back into that idea. He goes on as well to say, don't let anyone defraud you of your prize by delighting in self-abasement. Again, it's self-abasement. It's not something God's commanded us to do. The worship of the angels, it's not a clear understanding of what that meant. Did it mean that they were worshiping elementary principles? Did this refer to demonic spirits? It's not entirely clear in the context. Taking his stands on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind. At the very least, we know that they were reveling in things that were secondary and claiming that those were necessary because Christ wasn't enough. That's the point here. They felt that they had to have Christ and therein lies your problem. To have Christ and then to add the word end is your problem. Because as soon as you say, I have to have Christ and works to be saved, or Christ and this, you see the problem there? He's no longer sufficient. And so we have to get rid of the word end and say Christ is sufficient. Now, there's no problem in engaging in disciplines that will enhance my intimacy with Christ, but they are not in and of themselves necessary in the sense that they would cause me to have a relationship with God. I already have that. He's already identified with me, with him in his lordship and in his death, burial, and resurrection. So what I think he's saying here is that, look, you already have a prize. You don't need to be under their authority because you already have the true Lord. And he says, these are people who don't hold fast to the head, verse 19, from which the entire body being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments grows with a growth which is from God, which is very reminiscent of what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, that metaphor of the body, Christ in that case being the head, and therefore having authority and rule over the entire body. So that everything we choose to do, everything the body does is a product, really, of the brain. Frankly, all denominations in their own unique ways do that. But in the brother's case, talking about miracle, mystery, and authority, he says that we've used those to control people. Very clever notion that. Now, of course, he's writing from an Orthodox perspective and condemning the Catholicism. You have to understand that. But he says, look, we have used, you gave people too much freedom, he refers to speaking to Christ. And he says, we have corrected your teachings. And we have now put them under the law. You gave them too much, and people don't want to have that much freedom. It scares them to death. So we tell them what they do. That's exactly what happens. And by the way, the extreme example is cults. They give you a new name. They tell you what toothpaste you use, where you're going to live, what you're going to wear. It's a no-brainer. You see, and some people are really, I think, marginal personalities find that to be secure. Let me just complete my thoughts because we have to have our breakout groups. He goes on to say, if you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, in other words, when you died with Christ, you were no longer under bondage to the created order in the sense of the principles of ruling spirits or nature and nurture. He says, don't submit yourself to these external decrees that humans make up. He says, these things are going to perish with the use, and they all are external. They only have the appearance of wisdom. It's all self-made religion, do-it-yourself religion, self-abasement, severe treatment, but they're of no value because of fleshly indulgence. I'll conclude with this thought here. Simeon Stylites and others were called pillar hermits. A pillar hermit felt that it wasn't enough to be by himself. He had to go on top of a pillar and live there. So Simeon Stylites actually had a pillar made, and he had a platform on top of it, 3 feet square, and that's where he would live the rest of his life. So he had 9 square feet. They would bring up the food to him, you know, on a little system like that. And his view was that I got to get out of the world. Well, the fact is, you can get out of the world, but you can't get the world out of you. You know, you can still have just the same thoughts when you're up on that pillar as you can do when you're in the world. You see that? They're of no value against fleshly indulgence. If you just go into this, don't do that sort of a thing, that won't change the reality. It's what you bring into the desert. If getting away from the world doesn't mean that the world's gotten out of you. And that's why the deeper understanding is to invite the Spirit of God to break through. And for you to be in the world without being an agent in this world, without being overwhelmed by its value system. The danger would be that you could become arrogant and look down on people who have great more convictions in an area like that. I want to stress that we're not talking about commandments. Well, the works, I don't relate that to the stronger or weaker brother. I relate that to the fruit of the Spirit. I relate that to character. I relate that to various things that are done in such a way that I bear fruit. And so the works of James chapter 2, you show me your faith without the works, I'll show you my faith by my works. In other words, it is by grace through faith that we are saved, but the works are an evidence of that. They don't create it, but they are a byproduct of it. So therefore, James is telling us that if there are no changes in your life, if there's no fruit whatsoever, then you would be well justified in questioning whether you have the real thing or not. And that's why Paul says to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 13, test yourselves to see whether you're in the faith. So you have to, you know, for self-examination. There's no clear and firm rule on that. I think it would be, I think there's a case-specific situation where wisdom comes in. Wisdom is to do the right thing at the right time and the right amount for the right reason. You see, so wisdom then, I have to apply wisdom to that situation because there is no formula. So I have to say, in this situation, what is the best course to take? That's the question of wisdom. You could do that, but you could encourage them to say, look, we don't have that, you do. We just have to agree to disagree on that point. It sort of depends. But what I don't want to do is to put him in such a situation where he feels encouraged to go beyond his convictions and then do which is not of faith. So you can have people who are kind of like spiritual thermometers monitoring everybody else by their own tests. And I don't want to be under that tyranny. So there's a balance here. One side or the other can overstep their boundaries. I think it's a matter of understanding, though, the difference between convictions and command. Speaking the truth in love and showing grace is what really, I think, is what Paul's saying in Romans 14. And I say this, that your faith must be in one thing only, and that's in God's character and the promises that flow out of it. At the point at which I put my faith in anything other than that, I'm setting myself up for real disappointment. Remember the distinction we made before between the difference between faith in and hoping in and hoping for? Remember the difference there? Only hope in God's promises and God's character. You can hope for other things, but don't make that something you hope in because it'll disappoint you. Yeah, there's a difference between those two. What do you do when you discover that there's been something that you didn't see before or with clarity, or you're convicted, let's say, by sin? What do you do? There are two extremes that you must avoid. One extreme is to do this shallow thing where you never do any self-examination, you see, where you never really think about or review, what was this day like? What did I do that should have been different? That sort of a thing, where you just become kind of cavalier about it. That's the one extreme. The opposite extreme is to become morbidly introspective to the point where you just begin to be brutal about yourself. Here's what I try to do. There's a verse in Psalm 139, search me and see if there's any wicked way within me and lead me in the way everlasting. So here's what I do. I ask the Spirit to search me. In fact, you'll see it in my morning affirmations. Ask the Spirit to search your heart and to show you any areas of sin and to acknowledge these to the Lord and thank Him for His forgiveness. You notice what I said there? Acknowledge them and thank Him for this. You've already been forgiven of the sin because He paid for all our sins, past, present, and future, when He died for us. But you thank Him for the gift of forgiveness. And acknowledging is confessing. To acknowledge means to agree with Him that what I've been convicted about is in fact correct. I did the wrong thing. Suppose one person's tempted to boast about something, and frankly, they didn't need to say that. They wanted to drop a name, let's say. You know, and it wasn't really necessary for them to say who knew them. You know, some people are so insecure that if they wrote an autobiography, they would title it 10 Great People Who Have Known Me. You don't need to throw that in. So have you ever been convicted like that, or you said something that was a little unkind or whatever? The Spirit of God, as I often say, convicts in specifics, not generalities. He doesn't say you're a bum, you're worthless, you're no good. What He does is He gives you something that you need at that particular moment. He can't reveal all the light at once because we'd be blinded. There's a lot of stuff under the waterline you don't even know about. And He'll reveal that as you need to know it. But what I ask Him is let Him do the search. And then let Him convict me. And now the key is let me agree with Him and respond. And thank Him for His forgiveness and get up and move on. Not wallow on the ground or throwing a pity party, but getting up and thanking Him for His grace and moving on. You see the idea? But then Satan will put you in the guilt trap. God, you've come to God 50 times for that particular sin. He's getting sick and tired of it. He doesn't want to hear it anymore. That is a complete lie. Again, you believing a lie. The only power Satan has over you is when you believe his lies. And the point there is, no, the truth is that God is not doesn't have some kind of a limited number, but that you keep coming to Him, and in grace you receive that forgiveness. Because everyone here has certain flaws that we're going to repeat particularly frequently. And what we want to do is to be sensitized to that and to thank Him and move on. And don't allow a long time to occur between when you do something wrong and when you respond to God about it. You see, that's what some groups call keeping short accounts. Have you ever heard that term? Keeping short accounts. I like that. What he means is this. Don't wallow in disobedience. Deal with it right away and move on. You see, that's the idea. Instead of not feeling pushing God off to the side. You do something wrong, the Spirit convicts you, respond right away and get back into the right relationship. That's really what it comes down to. And again, there's this guilt trip. You see, guilt is something that the enemy will use to manipulate us. But Christ has taken away our guilt. There's a false guilt. Now, there's a true moral guilt that really drives us to faith in Christ, but there's a false guilt we can buy into as well. No easy answer. What I want to do is to tell them where I'm coming from. I can tell you, here's my perspective. Here's how I understand your perspective. And here's my perspective that in Jesus, in Messiah, we have all things given to us. You know, I can speak to someone in the name of Messiah or Yeshua. When I'm speaking with a Jewish person, I'll use the word Yeshua, not Jesus, by the way. Here's the interesting thing there. Those are laws that are not found in the Hebrew Bible. It's found in the oral traditions, that is to say, in Talmud. And that's a big difference. But here's the point here. Let's go back to the Hebrew Bible. Let's go back to Torah. What do you discover? Are you following Torah? You're not. Because it says in Leviticus, without the shedding of blood, there's no remission. So let's go back to Torah itself, and let's go back to this deal. What people want to do is always go back to the oral stuff. Let's go back to Torah and see how we're doing there. We don't have a sacrificial system and all that. So, you know, if I were going to deal with that, I'd say you have to deal with was revealed in the Tanakh, which is the Bible. I love these questions you're coming up with. These are great. Unequally yoked, I think, can relate more than just to marriage partners. I think it can be involved, and you have to, I can't make this a command, but you have to evaluate. If I'm involved in a fiduciary or in a trust relationship with someone where my reputation's on the line or something like that, then I have to evaluate whether that's a wise situation. However, at the same time, you can't avoid dealing with people in this world, because with goods and services and so forth, you're going to have some, you're going to always have those connections. The question you have to raise is, in your own situation, is this a wise course for me being in this particular partnership where my own reputation will be affected by the whole? And I don't have an answer for that. I'm not telling you that there's no firm and fast thing, but I have to evaluate that. I do think as to the marriage matter, it's pretty clear, because Paul makes that real clear in 1 Corinthians. Frankly, well, that's another matter, but I have to evaluate. Now, that's wisdom. Wisdom is to apply principles to specific situations. And when you're seeking wisdom, James says, if anyone lacks wisdom, what does he say? Let him ask of God, who will give that to him. So what I would do is, if I begin, let's use your illustration. Suppose I'm in a partnership or in some kind of a, or I'm thinking about a partnership, and I want to pray about that, first of all. And if I have any misgivings, when in doubt, don't, by the way. Or if I can defer a decision when I don't have peace, I'll always do that. There are some situations you cannot defer, but at least I want to pray for wisdom in this situation. Is this a wise course for me to take? Can I do this with a sense that this will be well? No one can tell you that, because there's no command on that specific situation. But I know some people who have convictions that they will not have a formal partnership with an unbeliever. There are some people who have that conviction. As, you know, so you have to hammer that out yourself. I don't have a rule on that or a law. That's where you have to hammer out. Let me conclude by defining a conviction again. We've talked about this before. A conviction is a thought-out resolution between yourself and God that governs your behavior. I'm going to say that again. It's a thought-out resolution between you and God that will govern your behavior. A command is something that you don't think about. That's something that God's given you. When it says don't commit adultery, you don't have to think that through. And I wonder if I should in this situation here, you know? Or, man, I've heard people blame God for all kinds of stuff. The Lord told me to do this, that always scares me to hear that. But instead, we're talking not about commands, but about convictions. What's my conviction concerning this? It's a thought-out resolution, then. You think it out. Hammer it out. Between you and God, that governs your behavior. And by the way, you need to review your convictions from time to time. You better revisit them. So I use the analogy of Stone Mountain. On the top of Stone Mountain, there is a barrier. You know, it's very, very subtle how it falls off. And you don't know where you are. But you can take one step, just one step, and one step too far. It's not noticeable, but you'll go down. So rather than put the barrier at that one step, they put it way up above that, so that you're not in any danger of going too far. Do you see the point there? A conviction's like that barrier. It's not sinful for me to go beyond that barrier to a point, but it might be prudent for me, knowing myself, to put in this barrier. So I'll give you one of my convictions. It's not a command. When I travel, and if I'm by myself, I'll never turn on the TV in a hotel or motel room. Just don't do it. Why don't I do it? God only knows what's on that thing. So I just figure better to be safe, you see. There's no command, therefore I will not judge another person who puts it on. I just know for me that if I'm not careful when I'm by myself, the flesh is looking for stuff to get, and it wants to suck it in. It's kind of subtly, you don't admit it to yourself, but you're looking when you're surfing. And so I figure, why put myself in harm's way? That is not a commandment. It's a conviction. Do you see the point? Because I know that this is an area that I'd better be very, very firm about. You see what I mean by that? That idea. And you have to have a conviction about other things, too. What kind of books will I read? What television will I see? And you have to ask yourself about that as well.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.